Hello, this is David Rovics, and you are listening to the Liberated Airwaves of 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Khadija and the White Guy. I'm Keith Washburn.
And I am Khadija Hardaway. Before we get started, though, I want to give a shout-out to my baby girl, Shaquilla Hardaway. She just turned 20 on today. She's no longer a teenager.
All right. Happy birthday to you. And our guest this evening is Pastor Michael Brooks, who is with Metro Organization for Racial and Economic Equity, better known as More Squared. And Michael Brooks is also pastor of Zion Grove Missionary Baptist Church. Welcome, Michael.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we are well acquainted because we were both in the early days of More Squared as an organization. And in about 2006, I was reminding him tonight, I remember him saying, we need to have an honest conversation about race.
Yeah, and seems like it was years ago, but it was only about 5 or 6 years ago, actually.
Yeah.
And so here we are now.
and the same thing, right? We need to have an honest conversation about race.
Some things never change.
Yeah, that one I think we all agree on. So, Khadija, what are your thoughts?
Well, how do you start an honest conversation about race? I mean, what is your definition of an honest conversation?
Well, I think the first thing is for the word honest in and of itself. What drives you when you hear the word race? What comes to mind when you hear racial equity? What comes to mind when you hear racial tension? And what really honestly comes up when you hear those things? Are we really living in a post-racial society? We don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. Are things still just as bad as they've always been? And we really need to do some more work.
Some people would say to have an honest conversation, they don't feel tension when it comes to race. You know, some people would say that. But I know as an African-American, I know the honest conversation for me would be along the lines of how I lived every day. And it as an African-American, it affects me, the education of my kids, my financial well-being, almost everything I do, my race is associated with it,
right.
You know. So would that be a part of the honest conversation? And do you think so much of that leads to the racial tension that you're speaking of?
Yeah, and all of that. I think when we started the conversation, I was kind of just responding to things that you hear all the time. So for people who feel like they're not racist or bigot, still they'll say something like, well, I don't see race. I don't see color. And my response to that is, well, if you don't see color, you don't see me, because I'm 6 foot, 210 pounds, and every day of my life I'm reminded I'm a black man. And the examples of that is walking through a parking lot and hear people lock their doors because they see a black man almost about to walk by. Going to a department store, if I'm dressed in a sweatsuit and a baseball cap, I'm going to get watched a whole lot closer than if I go in one of my suits and my ties. And so they're just small things that most people would think are insignificant that remind me on a daily basis, at least on a weekly basis, that I'm a black man living in society and things aren't equal. It's not the same. So to say you don't see race, I think, is kind of ignorant and a statement to make, because there's no way you can't see that someone's a different color than you are. And it's kind of almost a little offensive for somebody to say something like that. We're in this post-racial society because, after all, we got a black president. Well, the reality is racial tension is probably higher than it ever has been.
I'm going to give out the call-in number, but you brought up an interesting point. I'm going to touch on that after I give the call-in. You can join us. We would like to know what area you're calling from and your name when joining this conversation, 816-931-5534.
And don't be afraid to call in. Seriously, you can make up a name if you don't want to give your real name. We just want to know what to call you by and, you know, what area of town you're calling in from. But, you know, just call in honestly. Tell us your thoughts about this subject. And, you know, one of the things you might contemplate, all of y'all that are listening tonight, is just, you know, what is keeping us from having an honest conversation about race? What keeps you from having that with people that you know? You know, most people are fond of saying, well, you know, I have two black friends or whatever they might say, right? Well, what's keeping you from having that honest conversation with your friends?
You know, you brought up your the way you dress and how, you know, your day may go according to the way you're dressed. I find it ironic that when you see an African-American male, most people would say, he made it. He's one of the better ones. Mm. And that's just not true of the entire race, you know. There's a whole lot of African-Americans that are doing well walking around in business suits, and it's not out of the idea that they made it. It could be that they just decided to put on a suit that Sunday, you know what I mean? And they could be the biggest criminal. You know, it's just, I find it odd that, you know, the dress of a man is so prominent in people's minds, and I think it has a lot to do with media, you know. And media portrays this idea that race is beautiful, but at the same time it portrays African Americans as people who will rob, steal, cheat, and do all these different things to you, and that condensation type of thing, it goes with you every day. It's interesting to me. You know, I find it ironic that something so small and minute as the way someone dressed every day, because we all dress differently,
sure,
would be approached that way all the time.
Well, and part
the
of
the whole thing with the hoodie and Trayvon Martin, I'm sorry.
Right, man. Yeah, that's a great example. So, you know, and of course, there are some white folks right now who are saying, well, you know, I get treated differently when I go out dressed a certain way and so forth. Well, maybe. That could be true.
I agree.
And I also would add that you're probably not getting treated like a black person is dressed the same.
That's a little different.
Yeah, it's a little different. Because, again, the assumption is not immediately you're a criminal or you're going to do something bad. With the black person, I think that's we start with the worst scenario and work our way backwards. Mm-hmm. Instead of giving them the benefit of the doubt and waiting until somebody does something wrong, I think it's just the opposite. I think we expect them to do something wrong, and then when they do, it's like, see, I told you type of thing.
You know, it's the experience of sharing sometimes some of the things that happen to you with a white person or white friend, and when you explain it to them, it's almost as if they act like it's brand new. You know, like, I never heard of that. Oh, my God.
Well,
like,
that is terrible.
You know, and leading to one of the conversations we had before, it's like, you know, they say, well, I've never really been around black people, so I really don't understand. It's like, you do. You watch enough television. You see enough media.
A lot of, you know,
outlets.
I got to say right now, since we're talking about an honest conversation about race, one of the things that happened after Pastor Brooks said what he said, hey, we've never had an honest conversation about race. Then we had an event over his church, and we got black folks together with white folks around a table, and we each shared some experiences. And then when you can hear the experiences of your white brother and sister or your black brother and sister, it does help us all to develop a new understanding, if you will. And, you know, like, I would freely admit that when I was a kid and we went into certain parts of town, my mom said, lock the doors, kids.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and I'm not saying that was wrong. I'm not saying that was wrong of my mother. What I am saying is that you know, that gets indoctrinated into people's minds early on.
Yeah.
And it's not just like people are deciding one day, you know, I think I'm going to, every time I see a black person, I'm going to lock my doors. That's been there since they were 4 or 5 years old.
Hey, listen, I lock my doors around some white people. Have you seen Criminal Minds?
Okay. And I think the real goal, though, for me would be to, because we can always talk about our personal experiences, but my real goal is try to connect the dots to these systematic things that have gone on in our society that have created these ghettos and these places where there's just almost a permanent group of people who are underprivileged, underserved, who have no money, no opportunity, no jobs. And it's the education system, the economics, the housing, all of that. And I'm not sure, well, I don't believe it's by accident. that urban communities all over this country happen to be the way they are. To me, there was a systematic reason why these things happen, and there was a real detailed plan to make sure that the communities that we're living in, the communities we have to serve right now, were meant to be the way they are. And if we don't attack those systematic problems, we're going to just continue to talk about what's good, not what's not bad.
And so how do we start attacking the systems, or even just having the honest conversation? How do we do that?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that I'll just use as points of reference to begin.
Before you go on, let me sure. just give the call-in number again. It's 816-931-5534. And I have to say this, Pastor Brooks, don't get mad at me. Call in and talk to Pastor Brooks. You sound like Barry White. He's in the studio, y'all. So between him and Groovy Mike, we got it going on.
It's my day job. I think I'm going to radio.
Yeah, call in. Seriously, we just want to hear your voice, hear your thoughts tonight, and surely there's something that you could add to the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Go ahead, Pastor Brooks.
I think one of the biggest ones, if you just want to take, because the other reason why we don't do this is because racism and race issues are so big, nobody wants to tackle them. I think that was how I started the conversation when it came to Moore Square, that it's a big elephant in the room, and everybody wants to act like it doesn't exist. So you got to take it in pieces. So if you want to take the first piece, I think the first one would be education. And you can take that all the way back to even slavery times when it was illegal to teach a slave how to read. Because I believe people in power understood how powerful it would be if blacks learned how to read and got an education. I think that's still the case. People know the value of a good education.
You can never learn enough.
No. And if we can... dumbing down or manipulate the education so they're not as educated as other people are, or they don't have the same opportunities other people have, then we can create this, again, permanent underclass of people that stay that way, because education becomes a major form of this institutional racism that started, you know, even when the civil rights effort became positive, there was a backlash to that, and I think education was a big part of that.
Looks like we have a caller. So, caller, you're on the air.
Oh, great. I really appreciate it.
What's your first name and what area of town?
Hope I don't get too tongue-tied, but...
No problem. Just be concise. And if you would state your name and what part of town you're dialing in from, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. I'm Ted from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm listening on the internet.
Wow. Yeah, Ted, welcome.
So, well, I appreciate it. I just recently moved down here from the Kansas City area. For retirement community, but I'm really frustrated because I don't know. I look around and I don't see America. You know, I'll be in some group and it's like, where's the people? You know, where's the white folks? Where's the black folks? Especially where's the black folks? And it just doesn't seem right. And I don't know what to do.
Sir, if you mind,
I don't have any black friends.
If you mind me asking, what part of town are you residing in right
he's
now?
In Tulsa.
No, he said.
I'm living in the outskirts of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Oh. Okay.
But you know, I think. Well, let's see. I went to one of the black churches in my area, had a spaghetti dinner, and. You know, the lady was just so friendly and said, oh, sure you can visit. Come on by. And I don't know. I don't have any black friends, and I don't know. I don't know about getting up the gumption to do it. But, and I don't know what to do to help make things more fair. But I don't know.
Sir, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Is it because you grew up in an area where there were not any black people that you don't have any black friends, or because you seem to be pretty up in age?
Yeah.
I wish
I could figure out some way to be like a vanilla brother, and I'm just not getting the job done. Mm-hmm.
Well, appreciate you calling in tonight. And, Ted, if you think of something else, give us a ring back. And thanks for listening from Oklahoma, even.
Yeah, well, I just wish I could say, you know, I have good intentions, but if I do, why don't I have a why don't I have a good buddy who's a black man or what have you, and I'm just really frustrated, so maybe this will help us all. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Ted.
Mm-hmm.
So there are undoubtedly, lots of, now when I say lots, I don't mean a majority, but I'm just saying there are other white folks just like Ted who are wondering, well, what is the first step I could take? So one of the things that you're getting ready to do at Moore Square is you guys are going to have the, in Kansas City here, you're going to have a meeting.
Right, and I think one of the things you have to do is just be intentional about doing it. Just like Ted, I think I heard you say you went to a black church. I think that's an excellent idea. To go in that environment and find some friendly people that you don't mind talking to. Now, whether or not you become best friends or whatever, I'm not sure. But if you never expose yourself to someone else, then it's never going to happen. So I would say that's a pretty good first step. But, yeah, we're trying to be very intentional about bringing both black and white churches together to have this conversation. And we're hoping, again, we can create some safe spaces where people can really be honest and open about where they are and where things are, because I think it is going to take probably some very tactical people to get through the conversation, because you're going to have some anger, you're going to have some frustration, you're going to have all of that if we open this up, and I think that's what keeps people from having it. I'm not sure where it's going to go or what's going to happen.
What is going to make people open up in the conversation? I mean,
well, I think the facilitators that we're training to do the conversation, they're going to be trained on how to navigate the conversation in the right way. And again, we're not going to be talking about individual biases, but what are some of the systems that are in place that we can attack, that we can change?
So you mentioned starting with the educational system. What does that entail? Is it something that we're going to change the curriculum, or we're going to change the way they do testing? Because
I think,
so many levels,
yeah, I think,
you know, there's
right
biases
now,
in education.
I think the first step right now, the very beginning, has to be just educating people on how we got to where we are. Because I don't think everybody understands or even is willing to look at that. That when there was this white flight from the urban core, there was a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it created the school systems that we have right now. Because they wanted to move out and be in school systems, but they didn't have, their kids didn't have to go to school with black kids. And in the 60s, when the Fair Housing Act and all that stuff got passed, there was a real effort to get people out of those neighborhoods. Matter of fact, homeowners, white homeowners, were told, the blacks are moving in, you better get out now while your property value is still high.
Absolutely.
Because as soon as they move in, the property value is going to go down. And then we fund education based on the property value, the tax, the property value of the homes.
Which is
crazy. And if the property value is always going down, how are you ever going to have an equal education when the education in the urban core is never going to be equal to education in Johnson County or Lee Summit, because the houses in the urban core are never going to be $100,000, $200,000. And so if that's the funding formula, there's something wrong with that formula, because every kid deserves the same education regardless of what the zip code is, but not based on how we educate people. We suggest that a baby born in 64128 or 64129 or 64130 is not worth as much as a baby born in Johnson County, just based on how we fund education. That's a systematic problem that I think can be changed if we simply look at the facts and see that it's not equal. There's no way it's going to be equal, and it's never going to be equal unless we change some of those formulas. But, again, I don't think that was by accident. I think it was designed to be unequal. It was designed for certain people not to get as good education as others, because then we don't have to have an equal playing field when it comes to jobs and opportunities, because if I don't have the education, I'm not going to be qualified for the job.
I honestly see a bigger picture when it comes to the system, and it's capitalism.
The
use of human capital and making just about everything that functions and runs the country, you know, the jail system. I mean, all of it. You know, when you start putting dollar figures on human beings, you know, and you see that pie chart that says this person has, you know, is worth so much, and this person is worth so much over here, then that's the bottom line. And that's a fighting a giant, you know what I mean? To be honest, it's deeper than just the honest conversation and us infiltrating the system. This is a sleeping giant. This is huge.
And I think for the normal person that doesn't know the facts about how those two systems, because if you put those two together, the education system and the prison system, people that know that it takes a whole lot more money to keep a person locked up than it does to give them a quality education. To keep a person in a prison, it costs anywhere from $35,000 to $50,000 a year, depending on where you are. To educate a child at the height, it might be between $15,000 to $20,000 a year. We already know that. People in power know that. People that are over the capitalistic society. But we'd rather keep people locked up than give them a quality education.
It doesn't make any sense, does it? And, you know, Sister Berta, who I think most people listening in might know from St. Vincent's or now called Operation Breakthrough, she used to always say that. We've got a feeder system for the prisons.
Okay.
And, of course, you know, when are we going to run? Of course, now we're running out of room in prisons. So what have we done? We've capitalized that, if you want to say it that way. We've privatized it. So there's now these, you know, private corporations that are running prisons, and they're benefiting off of that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it does have to do with what's in it for me. And I would say, even what Pastor Brooks just said, which you may not agree that, you know, there somebody has intentionally done this or that. Let's say you don't agree with that. What you might agree with, though, is that the folks in Johnson County are definitely looking out for their own. In other words, they are not paying attention to what's going on with kids in the urban core. What they're paying attention to is how can we get better education out here in Johnson County, which is predominantly white, and, of course, the urban core predominantly black. So they may not, you might not agree that, well, they don't want to have black kids get educated. I'm not saying whether that's true or not true. What I'm saying is, for sure, they are looking after their own. And most people in Johnson County aren't the slightest bit concerned with giving everybody a chance to participate and everybody a chance to be part of a country that could be even greater if everybody were, you know, in the game, if you know what I'm saying.
But, you know, when you think about money and the makeup of money, it really doesn't matter what we think. We have to really get into the system. I mean, we can have a whole bunch of conversations, but at some point, the solution to that has to come out of a conversation. And so I applaud having the conversation early
right.
on. But I also believe in the process of having a hot conversation is, you know, equally yoked with solutions. And moving at the same time, a movement created at the same time.
Well, I think, and that's why I think the conversation initially is important, because I'm not sure you can get all of us agree on what the solution is. Because if I don't have a good idea what the problem is, I'm not going to really come up with a good solution. I'm not sure the average person understands how the school systems are funded. I'm not sure the average person understands how much money it takes to keep a person in prison and how much it takes to keep somebody educated. And I'm not sure, again, that people really understand that that white flight from the urban cores all over this country created a permanent underclass of people. And I don't think, again, now I'm a conspiracy theorist by heart, so I believe that was not by design. I think that was a 30, 50, 60-year plan for things to be exactly where they are.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
So the people that created that are not just going to let that go because we found out about it. They're not going to change the idea. But the part of that is those same people that moved out back in the 60s and 70s now are moving back. And now they want their property back. They want their own schools. They want, and that's why you had the school system dealing with. Before I get in trouble on this microphone,
but it's true. It's true.
So how can you come back to Beacon Hill and build a house that's worth $300,000? That's a stone's throw away from the ghetto, with houses that are only worth $20,000, and think that's equitable? And what kind of people are moving back into those homes?
You know, it's the income-based thing as well. And who are moving back in, their income is meeting that demand as well. You know, so you have to look at the system is a full circle type of thing.
Right.
It's holistic to people's lives and well-being. So if you do have a status quo or you're upper class and you move back in, you're raising that property value just by your income. And, yeah, a lot of people don't understand the system. But, again, I blame a lot of what we do in our day-to-day social lives that get us caught up in not facing reality of what's really going on. You know, a lot of people are mimicking what they see on television, mimicking what they're reading, even not just here, but across the world. You know, you're able to mimic whoever you want to. You know, I was reading about a young lady who was pretending to be somebody else and having everybody else help her do it. And nobody felt like getting her any help, but they would help extend. You know, so we live in an individual world where it's all about me. Yeah. How and we've lost that village type of thing,
no doubt about it.
Camaraderie.
Yeah, I think the word gentrification right. comes to mind with what Pastor Brooks was just talking about. We've got about 3 minutes. I don't think we have time for any more callers, but let's be sure and tell about the first event. Now, are you guys going to do a series of these?
Yes, so this is going to be the kickoff. The kickoff is going to be November 16th at St. Stephen Baptist Church. It's on 1515 Truman Road. If I don't have the address right, it's Truman Road in Paseo.
Truman Road in Paseo.
Pastor Eric Bell is there. We're going back to where we actually got all this started. That's where we had our first covenant ceremony when all of the congregations of Moore Square got together. We're going to have the conversation. And the kickoff is just a big rally to again, talk about these facts that I'm talking about today. After that, then every congregation gets to pick two times within the next couple of months that they're going to have individual conversations in their congregations. And so if you come to the mass rally, if you're not part of one of our covenant congregations, you can find out when those meetings are, and congregation may be open to other people coming in. And there'll be trained facilitators at each meeting facilitating the conversation, talking again about the facts of how we got where we are and what we can do consciously to bring about some change and do things differently. So I think, again, that's a good start. That kickoff is going to happen, the congregations will happen, and then there'll be a final wrap-up sometime in spring after we've had all these conversations to kind of see where we are.
Yeah. Khadija, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to say that a lot of times I have conversations with white people, and we end up in uncomfortable spots. But because we're looking for change, we often find a way to work through that. And so I urge a whole lot of people, if you're looking to just have a conversation, I don't think anything will happen to you. You know, I used to say sticks and stones break your bones, but words will never hurt you. And it's really about how strong your mind is, you know, because words really shouldn't hurt you. They should really help us come about with a solution.
Thank you. Yeah, now I just also want to put this plug in. As Pastor Brooks said, that's where we got it started. Moore Square actually has its roots back at St. Stephen Baptist Church. So I used to go down to St. Stephen quite often. And just as a personal testimony, I've never had any problems, not one, anytime I park down there. So, folks, come on up.
I drive down there. 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock
November 16th.
Evening.
It's a Monday. Yeah, it's a Monday evening.
We'll all right, 7 p.m. at St. Stephen Baptist Church. Again, it's at the intersection of Paseo and Truman Road. It's right off the highway there. If you're going east out of the city, it's the first exit. And I want to thank Michael Brooks for coming on the station tonight, former city councilman and also still the senior pastor at Zion Grove Missionary Baptist Church. Thank you, Khadija. And let's thank Mike, our engineer tonight, Mike Murphy, as always, doing a great job. And you've been listening to Khadija and the White Guy on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Coming to you live from the studios of KKFI Community Radio in Midtown Kansas City, it's time for Shots in the Night Radio Theater, the live edition. Tonight we will present issues of the day, including a visit by a popular politician, discussions with experts in the field of health care and the economy, as well as a preview of the holiday season. I'm Sally Downey. Ron.
What?
We're on the air.
Oh, sorry.
I'm Sally Downing, your hostess for tonight. This first piece is a little story called Chicken.
Sally, I don't think chicken is about the issues of the day. I think it's a leftover from Halloween.
Really? I thought it was about the weather. But at any rate, we're live, and you're in this one with Roseanne Devine, so you need to get ready.
Oh, okay.
It was a dark and stormy night.
Don't start that again.
Say it. Say it.
No.
Aw, oh, come on. I brought the flashlight.
Do I have to get under the covers?
Not if you don't want to. Chicken.
Don't call me that.
Chicken. Chicken Bailey.
I'm telling.
My mom don't care.
Yes, she does. She said...
She... What?
Stop talking about that night.
Especially with your cousin Bailey, because he...
Not just me, with anybody.
Do you remember?
Yeah, but I don't want to talk about it.
Because you are a chicken. A yellow-bellied cream of chicken.
You weren't there.
I was close by.
If you would have seen it, you would have been nothing but a pile of shiny sweat wetting all over your shoes.
But I heard the scream.
It's not the same.
I heard Mr. James screaming, "No, don't!" And the other man yelling, "Yes, yes!"
But you didn't see.
I heard. It's just as bad.
See, it was worse.
I heard it. The axe coming down on Mr. James's arms, chomping and pounding. It was awful.
But actually seeing the arm chopped up, all bloody, worse.
What else did you see?
Oh, you are sick.
The hand? Tell me about the hand.
The hand on the other arm?
Yes.
The other hand was trying.
Yes.
Mr. James was holding onto his neck, trying to keep his own head from falling off.
And did he dance?
What?
Did Mr. James dance like a chicken?
No.
What did he do?
He ran. Mr. James ran after the man.
Is that when Mr. James was yelling, "Freddy killed me"?
Yeah.
Did he catch him?
No, he was hurt too bad, and it was too dark.
And stormy. Don't forget stormy.
Yes, it was dark and a stormy night.
Ha! I knew you'd say it.
Chicken was written by Mary L. Wilkins. Angela was played by Roseanne Devine. Bailey was played by Ron Dennis. And I'm John Campbell, the new guy.
And now we have a special guest in the studio with us tonight.
Excuse me, miss. Is this shot? I'll tell you that. Is this shots in the night?
Yes, we're live on the air.
Oh, I'm Orville T. Flushbottom. You can call me Orville. I'm to be interviewed tonight.
Oh, that's right, Orville. Mark, I'm going to toss this one over to you.
Okay, this is your KKFI reporter, Mark Nagy, and I'm going to talk to Mr. Orville T. Flushbottom, who's running for Congress in Southern Missouri. Mr. Flushbottom, just why are you running for Congress?
Well, that's a very good question, sir. Now, I'm so glad you asked me that. I feel, as a native and veteran of Southern Missouri, it is my God-given duty to represent the people of this great part of our state. Often, they are out of shape and underrated as a majority, and I intend to correct that matter by representing them in Congress. I really do. Say, I do like your tie, young man. Now, there's nothing more beautiful than the red, white, and blue. Your next question, sir. Go right ahead. Now, don't be shy, because I have nothing to hide.
Yes, well, your answer seems a little confusing. I'm not sure.
Oh, yes, I can see where you're coming from. The political maneuverings of our great land takes an astute person to understand the meaning of getting things done for the people of Southern Missouri, and I intend to do just that. Now, remember, there's always been a flush bottom in the political realm in one form or another for over 100 years, from dog catcher to county deputy. Yes, I can understand your being a little confused or not having served the people for as long and as faithfully as I and my family have. But go ahead, ask your quick question. I'll help you get through this. I swear I will. Yes, I will.
Yes, yes, I. That never really answered my.
Take too long, young man. Oh, no. My nose tells me lunch is about to be served, and you wouldn't want to miss out on that good old Southern fried chicken and apple pies. And if I know the ladies were in for a treat, I'll top on that pie with a goodly amount of fresh, sweet whipped cream from the farm. Yeah, so go right ahead and ask your question, because as I said before, I have nothing to hide.
Let's see. I have some notes here. I'm not sure. What is your stand on immigration, or is that an issue? Or is that even an issue in Southern Missouri?
Oh, sir, now that's a very astute question. Whatever affects the nation affects Southern Missouri. The agricultural enterprise of this region often rely upon immigrant population for their assistance in planting, working, and harvesting our crops so that we can help feed this great country. Ever since the Civil War put an end to the platitudes of Northern aggression, we have welcomed the immigrant as a moral replacement to the investments of slavery. Now, I and my wife, the genteel and kind-hearted Prudence Madison Flushbottom, took in two immigrants, giving them sanctuary in our very own home, a lovely husband and wife, Eileen and Bentley.
Eileen and Bentley? Where did they immigrate from?
Oh, sir, that's a very stirring story. They lived in servitude on the tiny island of Britain. I met them in New York where they were struggling to find work. I brought them both back here at my own expense and procured for them jobs at the local Sleepy Time Motel and Cafe owned and operated by Prudence's very own brother, Beauregard Lee. Now, only in America would refugees landing upon our shores be able to put themselves up by their bootstraps and begin a life of freedom and hope for the future. I'm proud. I sound very proud. I'm able to help assist two foreign-born immigrants become productive members of American society and gain a path towards citizenship. Now, pardon me, sir, but I see my wife waving for us to come to dinner. We better get in there so the Reverend Uriah Flashbottom, that's my second cousin once removed, can begin the blessing. No more questions now, sir. I think I made everything perfectly clear where I stand on all the issues. We better get a move on. I tell you, young man, you're in for a treat. Yes, I am. I see my lovely cousin, Lulabelle Flashbottom. By any chance, sir, are you a bachelor?
A bachelor? Yes, but what's that got to do with... I don't know. I'm back to you, Sally.
Ah, right after you, sir. Go right on. Oh, Lulabelle, honey, put down that plate of fatback and grits and come on over here. There's someone here that's just dying to meet y'all.
Oh, no.
Orville T. Flushbottom is a creation of Ron Dennis and was played by Mr. Dennis. He was interviewed by Mark Nagy.
That was a good show, I'll say here.
Ron... The skit's over.
No, I say it isn't a piece of hair. It's what I call a comb over.
Ron's skit's over.
What? I can't stop this.
You're still in character.
I think it's a part of my DNA now.
Oh, stop talking and listen to our next guest.
It's hard to stop talking. I swear, it really is.
Next up on Shots in the Night Live is an award-winning economist who has devised a way to create a bustling economy. According to the Wall Street Journal, and I quote... We cannot find words to describe Dr. Ferguson's economic theory. Please welcome to the show Dr. Fred Ferguson from the University of Boston.
Thank you, Sally. Good to be in your fine city.
And thank you, Dr. Ferguson, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today.
Oh, please call me Fred.
The Wall Street Journal. You've turned some heads in our world.
I have, but I'd like to correct something you said earlier.
What's that?
Well, I'm not an economist. I'm an agronomist.
Huh?
It's a common mistake. The words are close in spelling.
Maybe we should take some time talking about how your agronomy degree relates to the economy.
No problem. At Boston University, the economics department is on the third floor hall of the North Church building. Agronomy is on the second floor.
And?
That's it. I've talked with lots of economists at lunch in the cafeteria on the first floor.
That's the basis for claiming your expertise in economics?
Oh, no, it's broader than that. We meet almost every night at O'Malley's Jug and Chug.
Maybe we should get into your theory, using layman's terms, of course.
Yes, thank you for giving me the opportunity to spread this good news, and believe me, all I have is layman's terms.
I don't doubt that.
It's a grassroots approach, able to be done by each individual, usually in their home. It's really very simple. Any single person with spare time can just draw pictures of a $1 bill and then use it to buy goods and services.
That's it? That's your idea? Fred, where I come from, that's called counterfeiting.
Oh, my, Miss Downey. Where I come from, it's called quantitative easing.
It's illegal. You're recommending breaking the law.
No. Our government does it all the time. They print money with nothing to back it up. Just like you and me when we draw a dollar bill. First, all we have is paper and ink, and then we have money. That's how they do it, too.
But, Fred, what merchant would take a fake dollar bill?
Ah, Sally, you underestimate the American entrepreneur. Here's how it would work. The dollar artist would hand the grocer three $1 bills for a quart of milk. If the dollars looked fake, the grocer would reject them. However, if it was a good job, the grocer might not notice, or he might be desperate for a sale and take a moderately good facsimile. When he could pass off to his milk vendor.
This is crazy.
It has other consequences. Because more and more people would become self-employed at this task, our unemployment rate would plummet. We would have no feisty unions to join because we would have no more unthinking and disagreeable managers.
It's
counterfeiting.
It's brilliant. There would no longer be any confusing payroll law because there would be no payroll, no accountants, no overhead, but for persons' living expenses. Which they occur anyway.
Thanks for stopping by, Fred.
What? I'm not finished.
Oh, but you are. We've been talking with Fred Ferguson, noted agronomist.
Miss Downing, wait. Do you need change for a 20?
No. Be sure to tune in next time for our interview with sportscaster Joe Buck, who will contend that he is the son of Jack Buck.
Dr. Fred Ferguson was created by Dane Zeller, played by Ralph Tomlinson, and interviewed by Sally Downing.
Ron, there's no drinking allowed in this radio studio.
Oh, this flask? You're mistaken, young lady. This here's a prescribed by my doctor, the very fine physician, Noble Van Langham. Oh, you've probably heard of him if you've read the medical journals. It's for a touch of the gout I have. Zills my nerves, quiets
Ron,
things.
You are not Orville T. Flushbottom. You really need to step out of character, dude.
Oh, sorry,
Ron,
ma'am.
You need help. And now, Shots in the Night is honored... Put that flask away. ...is honored to present an interview with the architect of a new health program that fundamentally alters the way we provide health care in America. Rosie, over to you.
Please welcome to the show Congressman Dane Zortgart from North Dakota's 1st District. So good to have you appear today in the Shots in the Night studios to give us your first interview following your introduction of your health care bill, H2001, the Simplicity in Health Care Bill.
Well, thanks for inviting me to your warm climate.
Warm? It's 41 degrees.
I had to break out my short sleeve shirt.
Congressman, you're from North Dakota's 1st District. Where is that? Does it include Fargo?
Well, technically, we don't have a 1st District. We only have one district, and yes, Fargo is in it.
I've been reading about your health care bill. It has two co-sponsors?
Yes, my good friends from Montana and Wyoming have signed on.
But the magazine Tax and Spend Quarterly has labeled your bill too simple.
I don't understand their point. In North Dakota, nothing can be too simple.
And the We Decide You Listen Radio News Network, your bill is exquisitely simple.
Right, they are.
I didn't actually read the bill, but that's why you're here today. Could you explain why you think it will benefit our country? I hear it's a very low-cost system.
That it is. No one will come up with anything cheaper. The idea grew out of my grandfather's practice of drinking one tablespoon of vinegar each morning.
Interesting.
He claimed it warded off heart attacks, colds, tremors, mosquitoes, and plotting women.
Plotting women? That's a health problem?
Indeed, it was for my grandfather. It is a proven fact that his wife served him fried foods, bakery items, desserts, and appetizers of the highest calories and fat content.
I'm not following this.
His wife was trying to kill him, don't you see? But he lived into his 90s, having survived his wife's efforts.
Are you saying that your solution is for everyone to drink a tablespoon of vinegar each day?
Yes.
You introduced a bill that relies on vinegar for health care?
Yes.
I should have read your bill.
Yes, you will find it simple in design and complicated to implement. For this system to be created by law of Congress, there will be some roadblocks.
No doubt.
For instance, a certain senator from South Carolina has a grandfather who drank a tablespoon of cod liver oil each day.
So it's more than vinegar.
Right. Congress would have to amend the Vinegar Act to include cod liver oil, and an ounce of Kentucky sour mash whiskey, and 4 ounces of lemon juice with 4 cloves of garlic and...
I get the drift.
But even this amended bill will have its simplicity.
I can't imagine...
Whatever is added to the vinegar bill, we will have a treatment distribution system already in place.
And that would be...
Our grocery stores.
Ingenious.
The grocers would give the vinegar to its customers and then send an invoice to the federal government.
You're not kidding. Your bill truly is simple-minded.
That's what I've said all along.
Congressman Zortgart, I want to thank you
Think
for...
Of it. Think of it. There would be no more costly malpractice lawsuits. The grocer would simply state that the vinegar was given to his customers in expectation that the customers would use it for salad dressing or for cleaning windows.
Clever. Thanks for coming by.
Wait, you haven't asked me about gallbladder surgery.
I hope you've enjoyed sunny Kansas City.
And there's the cholesterol amendment.
Good night and goodbye, Congressman Zortgart.
It's in the cinnamon.
The vinegar bill was created by Dane Zeller, and Congressman Zortgart was played by Dane. Interviewer was Roseanne Devine.
Give it a rest. Oh, I declare that.
Not funny, Bruce.
No, just a little hay fever, ma'am. That's a,
You are way too deep in this. I'm concerned.
Tonight's musical guest is Chip Martin.
Wait, we're doing this. Okay, just let me finish this line. All right, we're good.
Kicked off my campaign just the other day. Lots of bills and expenses to pay, but it's okay. Because I'm taking coke. I'm taking lots of coke. Yeah, I'm taking coke money. I'm gonna be people's politician for you and me. Reform this whole country. No, that's a lie. And you know why? Because I'm taking coke. I'm taking lots of coke money. I know I seem just like a puppet, but I have as much free will as a Muppet. Political values are horribly askew, but it's okay, cause I've just bought a cabin, the lakeside view. And it's all because I'm taking coke. I'm taking lots of coke. I'm taking lots of coke money. Every day I'm high and higher in the polls, thanks to these old greedy little trolls. Don't even notice the world flashing by. Think without this I would start to die. Cause I'm taking coke. I'm taking lots of coke. I'm taking lots of coke money. Coke brothers and me, we're such a happy family. And I've done things with my mouth that I can never say, just to keep on getting that sweet pay. Cause I'm taking coke. Taking lots of coke. Taking lots of coke. Yeah, coke. I just give me coke. Money, coke. Money, coke.
Woo! Yeah. Thanks, Chip. Chip is the artist formerly known as Martin Tomlinson. And now, an opinion piece on a pertinent issue of the day, gun control. The Thanksgiving Hunters by Scott D. Virginberry.
Oh, that's Rogan doing?
Yeah, my apologies.
Now, you two be careful out there.
Oh, my God, Mom, for crying out loud.
We'll be careful, honey.
It's Tom's first hunt. I don't want anything to happen to him.
He completed an NRA safety class. Oh. He'll be just fine.
Don't do something stupid.
Let's go, son.
I'm pretty amped, Dad.
I am too, Tom. Now we need to find some bushes to hide in.
It's been 3 hours since we've been out here. I'm cold.
You'll be all right.
I gotta go to the bathroom.
You should have thought of that before we left the house.
And I'm bored now.
That's the nature of hunting, son. You don't have a TV or smartphone out here. Be patient.
But I'm hungry.
You'll be okay.
My stomach hurts.
Just imagine, when we bag one of them, it'll be great to bag one of them and have one of them along with some mashed potatoes, some dressing, cranberry sauce.
You're making me hungry, Dad.
And pumpkin pie.
I want to go home.
Look, I see one of them now. Now be quiet. He's over there on your right, nibbling on some corn on the cob. I see him in my scope, Dad. Aim your rifle steady, son. Draw a bead on him. I'm ready, Dad. He'll be the best human a turkey has ever begged. Ready? Aim.
The dad was played by Scott D. Rogandewey. Tom was played by Mark Nagy. And Mom was played by Sally Downing.
I say, I gotta pee.
Ron, just leave.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to remind our audience of our Christmas show coming up December 3rd. To get you in the mood for the season, let's listen to Roseanne Divine tell us about the two theories of tree decorations in her original piece, Dad and the Christmas Tree.
When I was 5 years old, I came to the conclusion that there was no Santa. But I pretended to believe for 2 more years because I didn't want to disappoint my father, who I was sure believed devoutly in Santa Claus. Being a sensitive child, I didn't want to tell my father that it was Mom who put those gifts under the tree. I knew it would crush him to find out, so I pretended. When my sister Pat turned 5, she got wise and the truth came out. Pat was no nonsense, and she didn't care who gave the toys as long as she got hers. And she simply could not believe that a 35-year-old man was dumb enough to believe in Santa. Dad survived the disappointment and turned his holiday energies to creative things like decorating the tree. It was the same routine every year. We got a nice 6-foot Douglas fir. Dad hauled the boxes from the upstairs closet. Mom strung the lights, and Dad gave us instruction on how to place the ornaments. Large ones and homemade ones to fill the bare spots, the fancy glass up high where they wouldn't get broken, and others to fill in the middle. After the garland was swagged, Mom headed to the kitchen to make cocoa, and Dad brought out the tinsel. Oh, the dreaded tinsel. Dad would select a few strands from the cardboard and carefully drape them through our outstretched fingers. He would show us how to select one strand, shake it gently to untangle it from the others, and lay it over the end of a branch, one silver tinsel strand at a time. He would watch us get started and then make his way to the other side of the tree. One strand at a time. Every year the same routine, and every year Pat, who had the patience of an 8-year-old, would begin hurling fistfuls of tinsel at the upper branches. Now, I always identified my dad with TV fathers. He didn't sit on the porch strumming a guitar like Andy Taylor. He didn't call us kitten and princess like Jim Anderson. My dad was like Danny Williams. Remember Make Room for Daddy? Danny Thomas played this caring but volatile father. I thought my dad was a lot like that. Anyway, back to the tree. Pat was hurling tinsel globs at my father's elegant creation, and Dad came barreling around the tree yelling at her. Pat would plop onto a sofa in a pout, and as if on cue, Mom would emerge with Coco saying, "Gene, would you just let it go? But she's throwing tinsel at the tree. Let it go. She's 8 or 9 or 7. It didn't matter since it happened every year. And it's Christmas. Now drink your cocoa." He loved sweets. And by the time our marshmallow mustaches were licked off our faces, everybody was laughing. Someone would turn on the tree lights, and we'd look at the tree in the midst of the paper and the boxes and the leftover bulbs, and we'd all smile, knowing in our hearts that Santa was coming.
Thank you, Rosie. That really gets me in the mood for our Christmas show. Say, Mark, before we go, can you give us a little background here? What's the story behind the annual Lamplighters Parade?
Well, the Lamplighters Parade has been a tradition in Kansas City for over 100 years. Story starts like this. Before streetlights were powered by electricity, they were powered by natural gas. So there had to be lamplighters to light the streetlights every night. Traditionally, since they worked right around the twilight, the lamplighters would hit the bars after work. About 104 years ago, one such lamplighter, Sven Gudensen, got extremely drunk, fell, and hit his head. As he was coming to, he had a vision for a holiday parade for Kansas City. The first parade was actually made up of three horse-drawn floats, populated entirely with drunken lamplighters, Hans Brugger's Oompa Band, and for some unknown reason, a mime. Anyway, the parade has grown over the years. Through world wars, depressions, good times and bad, the completely imaginary Kansas City Lamplighters Holiday Parade has brought delight to Kansas City families every year. And on December 3rd, 2015, there will be the 105th annual parade. We'll have celebrities as well, including Inez Cucuruta and the venerable Hannah Bell Boone. And best of all, KKFI has exclusive coverage. So join us at 7:30 on Thursday, December 3rd.
Thanks, Mark. Sounds like a good time.
Well, that's the end of our show, folks. Thanks for tuning in and supporting your local community radio station, KKFI 90.1 FM. Visit shotsinthenight.org for more information and podcasts of previous shows. Now stay tuned for the local showcase, followed by Under the Radar with our good friend, John Todd. Good night.
And God bless America and the great state of
Ron,
Missouri.
Get out, Ron. Well, why, get him out of here.
Why are you kicking me in the rear, woman? I don't know what's going on.
Hey, can I get paid now?
Oh, as if.
No, I don't like this.